नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ऋषिर उवाच भादम उद्वौ दुखामोहम् अप्रथा च अथवात्मजा आवयोर अनुरूपो सा आद्यो वैवाहिको विधि ऋषिरुवाच बाधम उद्भव दुखामोहम् अप्रथा च अथवात्मजा आवयोर अनुरूपो सा आद्यो वैवाहिको विधि ऋषिरुवाच बाधम उवौ दुखामोहम् अप्रथा च अथवात्मजा आवयोर अनुरूपो सा आद्यो वैवाहिको विधि. Translation. The great sage replied, "Certainly I have a desire to marry, and your daughter has not yet married or given her word to anyone. Therefore our marriage, according to the Vedic system, can take place." Purport. There were many considerations by Kardama Muni before accepting the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu. Most important is that Devahuti had first of all fixed her mind on marrying him. She did not choose to have any other man as a husband. That is a great consideration, because female psychology dictates that when a woman offers her heart to a man for the first time, it is very difficult for her to take it back. Also, she had not married before. She was a virgin girl. All these considerations convinced Kardama Muni to accept her. Therefore, he said, "Yes, I shall accept your daughter under religious regulations of marriage." There are different kinds of marriages, of which the first-class marriage is held by inviting a suitable bridegroom for the daughter, and giving her in charity, well-dressed and well-decorated with ornaments, along with the dowry according to the means of the father. There are other kinds of marriage, such as Gandharva marriage and marriage by love, which are also accepted as marriage. Even if one is forcibly kidnapped and later on accepted as a wife, that is also accepted. But Kardama Muni accepted the first-class way of marriage because the father was willing and the daughter was qualified. He had never offered her heart to anyone else. All these considerations made Kardama Muni agree to accept the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu. So we see is in this then his main considerations. He's not mentioning, you know, how, you know, beautiful the girl is or any other kind of intentions that he has. But he's mentioning that the proper attitude and proper situation is there. And that therefore, according to the situation, then he can accept her according to the first class situation of marriage. So these are the considerations in considering marriage. When one is trying to figure what is a good match, then these are very important considerations here. So in this light, whatever the situation, then one must see what is one's purpose, or what is the purpose. Because here he's mentioning according to the Vedic system, so in a religious forum, under religious rituals, then he can accept the hand of Swayambhuva Manu's daughter. Because that is actually the forum of the Grihastha Ashram. It is a manifestation of combined efforts of the husband and wife to perform their duties within the Krishna conscious and Vedic rules and regulations. And by that combination, then they both benefit greatly, and if there's children, then they also will benefit. But if the considerations are outside of this, then the benefit may be very minimal, because benefit only to the senses does not actually do much for the mind, and definitely does nothing for the soul. And therefore, it is not considered very high grade of marriage, like these other types of marriage are mentioned. But they are from other considerations. Gandharva is simply there's a mutual attraction. Rakshasa, there's an attraction on one side. And they'll be attracted by looking at the girl. They'll be walking by or whatever, and they'll notice or hear about the girl, see the girl, then they will just come and kidnap her. So these are all based on externals. They're not actually, at this point, have they actually properly understood who each other is. The connection is through the bodily conception. So in this case, though we're not saying that these personalities are completely perfect, but the point is that the considerations are based on religion. That is the essential point. And from that, then they can have very high quality marriage, and the relationships in that marriage will also be of suitable attitude. Otherwise, then the marriage simply for other purposes will not find satisfaction. It means we see senses don't last. Engaging the senses are not very long term. Whatever you do, for a few moments they are pleased, and then after that, then this drops off. There's a Chinese saying that if you want to be happy for 15 minutes, eat a good meal. If you want to be happy for 6 months, get married. If you want to be happy the rest of your life, make a garden. Like that. So we see is that dealing with the senses is not very long. It's a short-term process. So, it becomes very hard to keep the senses always busy for, 25, 30 years. It would take some serious planning and effort to do that. But the satisfaction of the mind, that is much more lasting. One can still appreciate, even though the sensual pleasures of previous activities may be gone, one can appreciate the interactions between others, like the remembrance or even the experience or anything of the meal that one may have had years ago, that will be gone. But remembering the interactions and the pleasant relationships that were there at that meal, or the purpose of that meal, or that, those can still be appreciated today. So therefore, the Vedic culture doesn't directly address the senses. It directly addresses the emotions, and naturally then those situations will include the senses, because the senses are basically just an extension of the mind. The mind is the seat of emotion, so if the mind is engaged, naturally the mind is going to engage the senses, but as in the realm of emotion. What the Vedic culture entails. And then from that, then the mind being engaged in this way according to Krishna's directions, then the next step is to engage it according to Krishna's directions or in the spiritual realm, or according to those attractions to Krishna. Means the emotional platform means we're being attracted to Krishna indirectly. Means man thinks woman is very pleasant to be with, woman thinks man is very pleasant to be with, or the children or the parents, or all these different things, or whatever one has within one's possession, that association is very pleasant, but actually it's dead matter, so it has nothing for us as the soul to be attractive. We would not be attracted by it. So the Lord has entered in his universal form, has entered into everything and imbued all things with various potencies. And in this way, then we become actually attracted to Krishna. But due to our conditioning, we only see the matter in which he has empowered. We don't actually see that potency of Krishna's power. So then we think it is that situation that was really wonderful. You know, that is what's nice. You know, like when we taste prasad, we think it's because of the piece of cheese or the cauliflower or the sugar or like that. But actually it's because it's Krishna's tasted it. So it becomes Krishna. So that's actually what's wonderful about it. It's not the other aspect. But we see that aspect and take that as the main. You know, same way we will take the association between man and woman, that is what is wonderful, is being with that woman or being with that man, that's what's wonderful. But actually it's because that's Krishna's potency. Krishna is that potency of it. So that is what is actually there. So if we engage in that in religious principles, that's why it's important, because you're actually associating with Krishna. It's Krishna's potency. So therefore, since the interaction's indirectly with Krishna, Krishna wants it done through the way he wants to be interacted with. You know, like that. He doesn't want to be dealt with in the wrong way. So, just like there's rules for dealing with Krishna directly in the Pancharatra, like that, you can't just whimsically deal. In the same way, there's rules for dealing with Krishna indirectly through the material energy. So that's the first step we see. So the Vedic culture starts from there. What is the proper way of interacting? Then, if one is intelligent, then one tries to understand how to go to the next step, how to deal with Krishna directly, like that, without the interference of thinking that it's the material energy that is giving us the happiness. So that is the actual process. We see Bhagavad Gita starts off with this platform right here. That Arjuna is saying, you know, if we have this war, then, you know, then the women will be unprotected, we'll get Varna Shankar, the social system will just fall apart. So he is working on the platform that these are God's rules, and so they must be followed. And Krishna calls him a fool. Now, he's a fool because he's not seeing the next step. That's not the goal. The goal is first you see Krishna indirectly, then you start to see Krishna, you know, directly. That's the thing. So therefore he points out the soul. You've missed out, you think you're material energy, and you're dealing with material energy. In a pious way, yes. But you've missed the point that you're the soul, and the person you're dealing with is the soul. And that Krishna's energies are everywhere. That God is everywhere. So actually what's going on is the soul and God. That's what's happening. There's nothing else. You can't separate the two, the soul and God. That's all that's happening here, is the soul's interacting with God. But the soul doesn't know they are the soul and doesn't know that who they're interacting with is God. Therefore, then the problem comes is then we come up with attachments to material energy or impersonal concepts about God. So that's the idea. The first step is you have a desire, a material desire, you're attracted to that desire, but you deal with it properly because you know that behind it, what's attracting you is actually God, not the body, not the facilities, not the position, not the whatever may be there. That's the pious understanding, one who follows the Vedic literature. So the next step is understand, since it is God, then it's my duty to deal with him this way. Rather than I want this interaction, so this is the proper way I should do it. The next is, since it is my duty to deal with these energies, what is my position, how I should deal with it? Then the next step is to, from that, remember God directly. And then leave that attachment to the dealings with the material energy. So like that, one goes from Sakam to Nishkam to the liberated platform. And then from there to prema. So that is the natural step. So this is actually the bottom level of the properly situated Vedic culture. This is where you start from. And then from here you go up. So for those from the non-Vedic cultures, this is sounding very esoteric and very kind of mystical, or even not even practical. But this is actually where human life begins, is right here. This is properly situated, cultured human life, when one starts from that platform. Below that, it is approaching human life. When we engage ourselves in the Artha Shastras or in the Kama Shastras, then it's Vedic. But it's not really, it's a bit of a substandard. It's not really on the mark. And then when you drop below those, at least there, they're dealing in economic development, sense gratification, according to the directions of Scripture. But when you drop below that, where you don't follow Scripture, we just follow our own idea, then we start getting to also, besides, you know, the sub-religious principles, we also get into subhuman behavior. Then the human element drops out. Then we're just talking about uncultured humans like that. Yes. So then another point here is Prabhupada's giving the point is that what he's seeing is that Swayambhuvamana's daughter has given her heart to Kardama Muni. So once the mind is fixed, then that is very strong. So that's a very important element, is that the first person that the girl gives her heart to, then very easily, if that's cultivated properly, that can last for a lifetime. So she hasn't given her heart to someone else, because otherwise, if she's given it, then the mind will not be with him. The mind will be somewhere else. So that is, he's seeing that this is proper. Then he's seeing that the father approves of this marriage, and he feels it's suitable. So he's coming and offering his daughter to him like this. So then, when he sees this, then he feels that this is it's a religious arrangement. Yeah, any questions on this? Or? Yeah.
You were speaking of different types of pleasure.
Yeah.
So what is your experience then of sustainable pleasure?
Ed?
What's a sustainable pleasure?
Sustainable. The real sustainable pleasure is the soul with God. So through these direct processes of these five main aspects of devotional service, chanting, hearing Bhagavatam, associating with devotees, worshipping the deity, living in the Dham. These are sustainable because they're eternal. Within activities, and I think Rupa Goswami mentions that Vishwanath gives the details, that you have those activities that are eternal. They're called mukya, like that. Is they themselves directly give liberation. So these five are like that. It means they go on here in our conditioned state, they will also continue in the liberated state. So there's no breakage in them. Then you have what's called gona, or like it's secondary. You know, supportive, but more directly supportive. So then things that enhance that, you know, like different arrangements we may make for doing those activities and all that. You know, like our cooking or our different things that we may do. You know, or making some arrangements, those are, you know, quite favorable, like that. Then there are things that are neutral, that are good, but it's not that they are directly giving. You know, like you take your bath in the morning or that. It itself doesn't. It makes you clean, so then you can practice cleanliness, which that is more favorable. But even that cleanliness is not. It's the cleanliness you're going to use in deity worship or in something else. And then, so all those then are, so yeah, and then below that are then things that are maybe bona fide but aren't specifically useful to us. You know, it's just like, let's say, worship of the demigods or, you know, Shraddha ceremonies, that they're bona fide things, but for us they're not useful. Then there are things that are like opposed to the whole process. They actually break down the principles of that the whole process is based on your purity, your cleanliness, your austerity, your all these different things. So he gives five levels. So then what's in the first level, that is sustainable. And of those, then the one that can always be appreciated is the chanting. Because whether you're with devotees or not, have the opportunity to read the Bhagavatam or not, or worship the deity or not, or be in the Dham, then that can always be appreciated. So if by purification one can get oneself to the platform of taste, of ruchi, then from that point one will, you know, very directly and dynamically feel that happiness. Up to that point, because of our impurities, then we will be able to appreciate it or not, you know, because the mind gets distracted. There's this element always remember Krishna, never forget. So the always remember are basically these five activities. And the never forget means performing all the other activities that are supportive so that we become purified. Because never forget means that we have forgotten because we're attracted to various things in the material energy. So the process of never forget is take all those, survey, contemplate or take advice from others. What are those areas where we have those attachments and attractions in the material energy? Then scientifically connect each one to Krishna by some method of, some proper method of engaging it in Krishna's service. Then that will then take what is taking us away from Krishna and purify it by engaging in Krishna's service. And then slowly purifies and bring us out of that attraction to the liberated platform. So as long as we have those attractions and attachments, then there'll always be the times, either moments or very extended moments, where we don't remember Krishna. And so we don't taste that long-term happiness. And then we become distracted into the short term. And either from it, according to the situation, we either get some happiness out of it or we get, a little bit more distressed. Like that. Is that?
Well, I agree with all that. Okay. No, because I'm not sure how much importance you want to put on that Chinese problem.
Uh-huh. But you want to talk about gardens? Is that
whether or not, because you're saying the element of that Krishna,
mm-hmm.
So say somebody eats a meal and they feel happiness, but then you say that happiness is Krishna.
Yeah.
Right? We say everything, the taste of the water, whatever, that's Krishna.
Yeah.
So then, if it is Krishna, then why isn't that sustaining us? Why isn't it that after 15 minutes, that taste of Krishna, then we're not, so to speak?
Yeah, but one can remember Krishna. That's the point. See, it also depends on this, because there can be two levels in this also. One is dangerous and one is not. One is beneficial. The beneficial is that since this is Krishna, then we approach Krishna in a mood of service. And so therefore, whatever is expected of us, whatever is our duties in this relationship, we do. We sit properly, we respect the prasad, we offer some prayers, we eat properly, like that. What's dangerous is we may understand it's Krishna and we want to enjoy Krishna, like that. So that's considered a lower level, like that. So that was, and that doesn't attract Krishna, like that. He'll interact, but it's very minimal. But if the service is there, then we get that. So what happens is we go from the one and then we start remembering Krishna. So that's what's sustainable, is the remembrance of Krishna. But the senses itself, because it's coming through the medium of the sense object, so therefore the senses have a limited time that they can appreciate something. But understanding that this is Krishna, that's coming through the mind, maybe in the beginning through the intelligence, but from there, the idea is to get it into the mind, that the mind can appreciate it. And once that's there, then that can always be appreciated. So that then on that platform, then it won't. That won't go. So that's the whole idea in the Vedic cultures, that the what is felt by the mind, that can be appreciated if you're dealing with something long term. And that's only Krishna. If we deal the mind upon getting what it wants, that pleasure will be momentary, because what it's dealing with is also momentary. The material energy is momentary. But if the mind connects with what's behind that, Krishna, the energy, then that's not momentary. Is that any better?
Extension sounds like the same prophet of that Chinese saying that of gardens, if one wants to enjoy for a year, then he plants rice. And if one wants to enjoy for 10 years, he plants nut trees. And if one wants to enjoy for eternality, he studies books and shastra.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question regarding Kathiya, what you were discussing about Dharma, and how devotee hasn't been part of the process of like Dharma, Arachakam, and Mokka. But we see in Chanakya Pandit's advising the king, and he puts great stress. He says that Dharma is dependent on Arta and Karma, economic development, and sense gratification is supported by that, and doesn't exist separately. Which seems to be the other way around, because a lot of stress on economic development, and then the devotee, that process of Arta, Karma, Moksha is not really our process. But we also see in a marital situation that even Kadana Mundi, later on, he develops, by mystic powers, Arta, or economic development in the form of palace, and also Karma is the order within the marriage. We see that you have to produce children, then one has to have economic development, and also sense gratification indirectly. So how does that fit into that? If we just try for Dharma, it seems like those other things get neglected sometimes in the devotee's life, or
The important thing is to understand Dharma and the purpose of Dharma. See, as Chanakya Pandit, he's a great Brahmin. And the principle is what is of value we take. It doesn't matter where it's from. You know, gold is taken from anywhere. So he's mentioned as a great Brahmin. That is no doubt. But he's not mentioned as a devotee. Right? So the whole point is, as we see in the process of the mind, and the process of just, you know, how the cosmic creation works, rasa works, interaction works, is there must be a goal to something. Relationship is established by Dharma and what is the nature of something and everything. But now, depending upon what your goal is, that will determine your action. Right? Depending on what you want with something, then you'll deal with it differently. Like, you know, one kid sees a rock, you know, then he sees the rock in his hand as a suitable, you know, relationship. But now, depending on what the goal is, the action will be different. For one kid, then, picking up the rock, then he sees, you know, the rock, his hand, and the window over there, so then, and breaking the window is his goal, so then the process is then throwing it towards the window. Another kid sees, you know, the rock, his hand, and then thinks of the glass on his desktop and thinks, this rock is a very nice rock, I would like to put that, take that back to my room. So he picks up that rock and takes it to the room. He doesn't throw it. So depending on what your goal is, then with those same items, both of these situations, there was hand, rock, and glass. But it was different, the process, because the goal was different. So that is what is important to see. That was what Arjuna missed, is his goal was wrong. So therefore his process is wrong. You know, just because you can see the relationship, and that you have to see where you're going with it. That's the thing. You know, it's just like the yogis also see the soul and God, and that there's a subservient relationship between them. They also see that. So Sambandha appears to be proper, but their prayojan is wrong. They want to emerge into the body of God. Therefore, then they follow that process of yoga and then do that. Does that make some sense? So, no activity, Manu mentions that no activity is done unless there is, you know, a goal like that. He says even the great sages, they don't do anything without a goal. So depending upon your goal, then it's different. So for Chanakya, then he's working in the realm of this Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha. So therefore, then you have to balance those. If you put so much emphasis on Dharma, then the person who's doing the austerities and those kind of things, there is no Artha and Kama. Right? Someone who puts it all on economic development, he has no time for Dharma or sense gratification. Right? The man is out at the business working hard day and night. He doesn't enjoy any of it. Neither is he doing anything religious. The person who's just enjoying all the time, then your economic development is dwindling. Right? To enjoy, you must spend. and then dharma is not being performed. So then there must be a balance if your purpose is karmakanda. Like that, you must balance them. But if your goal is something else, is liberation, which is Kardama Muni's purpose, right? He did austerities, pleased the Lord, got his benediction, that he wants to come to him, but he has these desires, so he wants to purify them. So if he would be kind to bless him with a proper religious marriage, that by that he could become freed from material contamination and again could then take up his austerities and perfect his life and become his devotee. That's what he wants. So he's going from dharma to, through moksha to bhakti, to prema. When you have dharma, artha and kama come automatically. You know, like if you have the cow, you have, you know, the calf walks along, or if you can't drag the cow comes. Like that. Like, I don't know here, but like you see in India, they put the rope around the cow. The calf, they don't. Because if the cow goes, the calf just follows. So you don't have to put a separate rope to catch the calf. The calf comes with the cow. So when you have dharma, automatically artha and kama will come. It's just a matter of the time. Like that. So that's that one point. The second point is that we see, you were mentioning that later then he created artha and kama like this. But that's also part of dharma. Because he knows the dharma. Dharma means the nature. The unchanged, inherent nature of something. So the inherent nature of a woman, of a wife, is that they require those facilities. They require children and they require the facilities for that. So it's part of, for him, it's not part of artha and kama. For him, it's still dharma. Understand? Because dharma includes that. Some people drop down to the artha and then down to the, their consciousness drops when they move those. But persons like Kardama, it doesn't drop. His consciousness is on dharma. Dharma includes the kama and artha, you know, and moksha. It's all there in dharma. So if you keep the proper consciousness, then you can deal in those and not be affected. Therefore, he could produce all that and he doesn't become overwhelmed or attached or deviated from his you know, proper principles of religious life. He knows this is what. She's a princess. If she was not a princess, if she had been a Brahmin girl, he wouldn't have needed to create a flying palace. Because she would have grown up in a hut like he was living in. So therefore, for her, the hut is facility. For a princess, as a woman who she marries, she will adjust with whoever it is. That's her dharma, that's her nature. And in that way, she'll be satisfied. You know, her satisfaction is doing her duty and pleasing the husband. But he, knowing that she grew up in all opulence, it would be natural for her to be comfortable in such an environment if the husband provided it. So therefore, knowing that, he provided that. We see also Chavana, same thing. He's the direct son of Bridhu. So then he's, you know, Bridhu Muni is, you know, great Brahmin. So he's there and he's living and he's doing his austerities and he's covered by an anthill. So, you know, for him, you know, there's no problem. It's not a problem for him. So then this girl, Sukanya, poked his eyes out, you know, unknowingly. And then because of that, being blind, how is he going to take care of himself and do anything? So since she did it, then naturally she should be the one that rectifies the situation. So, and you know, you can't put a man and a woman together like this unless it is natural, you know, of a daughter or mother. So therefore she has to become his wife. So then, like Kardama Muni also, for some time, then he tests to see the actual sincerity and how fixed is the wife in religious principles. And when both of them are satisfied that they are fixed and they are sincere in performance of their duties, then knowing what is their background, then they try to, you know, if they have the facilities, then they create it for them. Kardama is a great mystic, so he could create the palace. If he wasn't a mystic, then there would be no palace. He wouldn't endeavor for it. It's out of his, you know, out of his ability, like that. And Chavana, because of his prowess, then he could arrange that the Ashwini Kumaras could get again their share in the sacrifice. So he said, I can get this for you, you do this for me, you give me back my eyesight and make my body, you know, youthful and beautiful that would be attractive to such a young girl like Sukanya. Seeing she's a princess, princesses like, you know, Kshatriyas will be very attractive and very handsome. Brahmins generally, not necessarily, because of the constitution, Vata constitution, that makes things crooked. So therefore, symmetry is beauty, like that. You always hear in the, not, it's not so much here, but in the Mahabharata, whenever it describes the beauty of a boy or a girl, it's always described according to symmetry, like that. It means someone that we see, someone is very beautiful, someone's not. It's because they're beautiful because everything's in the same place. The two eyes are exactly in the same place, their forehead's in line, the nose is in line, everything's in line. Well, those who aren't as beautiful, you'll check, and they're not in line, like that. You know, teeth are in line, or they're not in line. You know, the limbs are the same, or they're not, or like that. That's even modern. I read a study on that a few years back. Someone, they saw that the symmetry made what was beautiful, like that. So vata, air constitution, which generally Brahmins will have, then creates a lack of that. So they generally are not as beautiful. Their attractive feature is their Brahma Tejas, like that. Though sometimes we do hear of very beautiful Brahmins, you know, or Brahmin girls both. Like Ahalya, she was very attractive. You know, Indra came to approach her. So there. So, but in the Kshatriyas, then the Pita and the Kapha, then they make for that very nice beauty. So then he asked the Ashwini Kumaras to arrange that. You know, but still they wanted to test also whether they wanted to, you know, make that arrangement. So then they tested by taking the husband into the pond, and then all three of them dipped into the water, and when they came out, all three of them looked exactly the same. The Ashwini Kumaras already looked the same, but then the husband also looked exactly like one of the Ashwini Kumaras. So then his wife, whoever she chose would be her husband. You know? So then, if you look at it from one sense, then what's the problem? I mean, she either gets her husband, you know, who's a nice sage, you know, great, but if not, she gets a demigod, you know? So, I mean, there's no loss, you know, for her. But because artha and kama is not the purpose, dharma is, therefore, is I should be connected to my husband. You know, whatever, even though it may be an inferior position to the Ashwini Kumaras. So therefore, not being able to tell the difference, she prayed to the Ashwini Kumaras, though she didn't know which of them were them, that you please reveal to me which one's my husband. Like that. And so being very pleased that this is a chaste girl, then they pointed out, this is your husband. But he did all that just because she had proven her dedication to the religious principles, and because of her background, and because he had the ability to do it like that. So it's not actually artha and kama. If it was, it wouldn't be in the Bhagavatam. So you see so many stories in Mahabharata, but and same stories are in Bhagavatam, but we find they've been reduced down to essential points, and some stories are left. So there's stories that are left, many times they don't necessarily have something that's so important for directly to devotional service. Indirectly, yes, but not directly. So those that are really important that are in here, because we see is the mentality is brought out, the devotional side, the artha and kama aspects are left. So dharma in relationship to spiritual development, that is what is brought out in the Bhagavatam. That's why it's so important. Because we take what Chanakya says, others say, and bring them into light of the Bhagavatam, then it's useful. If we just take them on their own straight, they're good, they're pious, but still then we're on the same position as Arjuna is in the, you know, first chapter of Bhagavad Gita. You know, like that. Pious, nice guy, but not very intelligent. His real intelligence is choosing God consciousness. Like that. Does that make any sense?
So it's God minus work. My greenhouse has to be then. If we pursue dharma and just in the truthfulness, then we just allow after the karma, the follower should be pursuing them.
You don't pursue them separately. It has to be seen. That means anything, even you want to do, let's say you want to run a business, there's a way business works. Like an essential element of the religion of business is buy cheap, sell expensive. If you do it the other way around, it's against religion. The business won't work. If you go out and buy a product for $10 and sell it for $2, is that business? No. So it's against the actual nature of business. So that's the point, is the devotee approaches everything through dharma, religion, like this table. Means you put the flowers here, right? You don't put them here. If I put them here, they will fall onto the floor. If I put them here, then the purpose of the table. Why would I put them here? I don't want them on the floor. Like that. If I see some dirt here, that goes on the floor. Right? I don't put that on the table. What goes here is things that should be off the floor, because that's what the dharma of a table is to keep things off the floor. Like that. Plus I know, you know, this is the top. I don't put this down and this up. You know, I could say, well, it's really good, it's round, you know, you can put nice round things in there, you know, just put your football there, you know, it'll sit really nice, you know, but that's not what it's meant for. So, to do any of those things would be against the religion of this. So, therefore, one can do everything, make money, you know, engage the senses, conceive children, all through dharma, because one knows the nature of what the activity is, what its goal purposes are, and how to attain those purposes, all through religious means, like that. So there's that overlap. The internal mood is spiritual, though the external activities are dealing with material energy. So that is the principle. That's what Bhagavatam is giving. So it kicks out anything else, all other religions, you know, that are not doing this. If you're not doing it according to religion, that's kicked out. And if you're doing according to religion for artha and kama, that's also kicked out. If you're doing it according to dharma because Krishna made the dharma and you want to please Krishna through those activities, that is what's being presented. And not only that, then what goes beyond that to the transcendental platform, where one is beyond having to deal with the condition of the nature. 10th canto, then you're dealing with spiritual forms, spiritual nature, spiritual everything. But up to the 9th canto, they're showing how the devotees bridge the gap from my conditioned nature to the spiritual form, you know, the liberation. So that's what it's for, is how to get through those stages. You know, you have this, you want to get married, okay, how to do that for Krishna. You know, you want to fight, how to do that for Krishna. You know, you want to go to school and all that, and or deal with your father, then how that's done. Prahlad with his father and how he dealt at school, and, you know, all these different things. How you want it, you want to, you know, understand the universe, get into astrology, how is that done? You know, all these things are shown, how to every aspect of human life that's important, how that can be understood through the religious principles in connection to Krishna. That is what is being given. That's what Bhagavatam's giving. With the purpose that you're going to come to the liberated platform, receive back your spiritual form, and in that spiritual form, then perfect yourself. So then we see, then through the Vrindavan pastimes, how someone perfected himself from the beginning stages where not having that a complete attachment to Krishna, to having that complete attachment and coming to the platform of prema. So that's also shown in all those fine, subtle anarthas that on their platform must be removed, and also then there's the acharyas also explain the gross aspects of them that are there for the sadhakas. And so all the demons and all the different things that they go through until finally then they get to the point of, you know, that purvarag, that complete attachment, and then coming to the platform of prema. Like that. Then once that's accomplished, then Krishna goes to Dwarka. So then we see that Bhagavatam is a very scientific how to practically, you know, it's a manual how to engage our life in Krishna's service. That's what it's for. Is that okay?
Maharaj, yeah. It almost seems like before you establish a relationship with someone, you have to know the goal. We place more emphasis on the Sambandha than the Abhidhamma. Prayojana is sort of, it's there, but it doesn't seem to be so emphasized in detail as Abhidhamma activities that we're going to perform to get there. So my question is, how does the Sambandha established in the first place? It explains how the activity is different according to the goal. Somebody smashes the window, or somebody takes the rock on. They perform different activities because they have a different goal or a different purpose. But how do we establish how is the original relationship established between the jiva to desire to go back to it?
It's established through association. We see the first thing in, even though like chanting Hare Krishna is the most important of all the five elements, but actually that's only established by association with devotees. So it's by association, then we actually gain that mood. So you have a proper mood, because the relationship, you have the living entities or you have the objects, but there must be what is the mood between them? So that's the sthayi bhav. That has to be actually established first. If that's, until that's established, then what exactly will be the relationship and then what will be its goal. Like you have Krishna and you have Mother Yashoda. So you have a woman and you have a boy. So then, but because the sthayi bhav is parental, therefore the relationship is parental. So the goal is to, you know, serve Krishna through the parental activities, please him through that, show your affection for Krishna through that. Therefore the anubhav, the activities will be in accordance with parental rasa, and there'll be endeavors that match that original mood. But if you take Radharani, so then you have also the same, a woman and Krishna, but because the sthayi bhava is different, therefore the relationship would be viewed differently. So the mood you gain from others, that's why you must follow in the footsteps of the residents of Vrindavan, because you have to gain that mood. And Rupa Goswami says you must associate with those more advanced than yourself, of like-minded mood, because then you gain that mood. And then when you look at the objects, then you will put them together through that mood. So then you're already your goal and all these things are there. So the aspect is goal must be there, but it's like from that, is your goal is to love Krishna, please Krishna. So then whenever you see something, then you will see how to put that together so that matches that goal. And then according to what it is that you're dealing with, then you will act accordingly. Like that. Because goal is very simple. Like that. Sambandha is more complicated. You know? And the Abhideya also has to be specific. But the goal is simple. You know? Somebody does something. Why do you do this? I want to be. Why do you ski? I want to be happy. But the process of, you know, learning that skiing, doing that skiing, getting all the paraphernalia for the skiing, that's very big. So that's why more conversation is on it, because more detail is required. But the goal is simple. Therefore, you know, we want to develop love for God. That's it. That's the prayoja. Within that, then we can get down the whole science of that prayoja. So you can break prayojan into sambandha abhideya prayojana. So you have, you know, sambandha prayojana, abhideya prayojana, and prayojana prayojana. Same in abhideya, same in sambandha, like that. So you always have these aspects. You can break them down. One, that is your main field. So whatever is your field, that's where it's mainly established. So if we're trying to develop faith, then sambandha is the main emphasis, because that's where all the things. You know, we're God. God's not God. You know, everybody's God, but not God. You know, all these kind of things. So there is no God. You know, there is no soul. You know, so all these things, those are all sambandha. So those all have to be. So the most conversation will be on that. Then the process, what is the process? What's not the process? You know, and then, because we're so used to material energy, how to spiritualize material energy? You know, like that. Through the devotional process, how to spiritualize. So then so much discussion has to be there, because the mind, being so used to dealing with the external energy, is very external. So then you give it, let's say you say a point and you give an example. So the idea is you'll catch the principle through that example, and then you'll be able to apply it in any situation. But many times, until that kind of like develops in the mind, or develops in that particular area, then you give the example, you understand it in that area, but not in any other area. So therefore, for any one principle, you may have to give, 10, 20, 100 examples till finally it, clicks. Like that. But one should be enough. Previously, it means you don't have to give any, you just mention the principle. Like in the Upanishads and like that, they don't give the example necessarily. Sometimes a small analogy, very simple analogy, and that's enough. But the Puranas then go beyond the analogy and give a whole history and application of it. Then we can catch it. And then, even then, many times we have to hear 10 stories that tell the same principle but from slightly different angles. This one was a Brahmin doing it. Okay, but I'm not a Brahmin, I'm a Kshatriya. But in this story, here's the Kshatriya doing it. Yes, but that was the emperor. We're not emperors. We're just, regular. But here's one where there's this king. Yes, but we're not in the palace. We're out in the forest hunting. So here's another one with that, it's like that. So that's the problem. Is the mind will always say, you say this. And then it will think, that's not me. Like that. So until that kind of like subtlety is there in the mind, then it has to be over and over. That's why it looked like there's so much bulk on that. But it's the others, it won't make sense. It's just like Nectar of Devotion. For most, the first, chapters will make the most sense like that. The last three sections of the Nectar of Devotion, it's not areas that are really may mean a lot to the sadhaka. Like that, in the beginning stage. They're nice, you read them, they're nectar, they're wonderful, and then you forget them. Because that makes sense when you get purified, because that then becomes your field. So then you can bring out the details then. And if not, then you bring out the detail in whatever field you're in. Does that make some sense? So that's why you see the Gita will be emphasizing on the Sambandha aspect. Just establishing who God is, who the soul is, what is the process, what is the goal, and all these. But it's specifically putting that out. Bhagavatam will be more on the process. Chaitanya Charitamrita will be more on the goal. They all three discuss all three aspects, but the emphasis is in the one or the other. Like that. Like you get more fine details of the Trayojana Tattva mentioned in the Antya Lila, Chaitanya Charitamrita, then are in the Bhagavatam, though they're all in the Bhagavatam. But if you know the science, then you see it there. If you don't, then it's not. It's mainly telling you how what is process. How to engage in the service, like that. And then the fine points of it are brought out there. And the foundation of that is given in Gita. Anything else? Rantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Guru Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivarinda ki, Jainita Gaura Srebrenda.